Hi, everyone. Welcome to the 10:15 session of Sunstone. Today's session is titled The Polygamous Daughter Healing in the Aftermath of Trauma and Abuse. If your cell phones have a ringer, think about turning those off. As you listen today, we invite you to explore what it means to be a Mormon. Who gets to carry that label? What does the history say? What does the theology say? At this conference, we encourage you to explore what it means to be Mormon. We don't like labels because the reality is there are as many labels as there are people, which is why you'll see that in your name badge sleeve that we have allowed you to label yourself as the kind of Mormon that you are or want to be. If you haven't yet, you're welcome to grab a Sharpie at the front desk and disrupt the Mormon narrative and write down the type of Mormon that you are. This session is going to be recorded. You can purchase it at the end. Let's see. Also, there are Skull Candy headphones that have been customized for Sunstone that you can get that will help support this wonderful institution. Your support goes directly to supporting the symposiums and keeping thoughtful dialogue alive and sustainable. Don't forget to check out the bookstore that hosts Benchmarks Books, considering purchasing a book or two to support Mormon studies and scholars. The session is 60 minutes long, so it will end at 11:15. There will be a question and answer period. And we ask you, if you can, that if there are people that you want to talk to or further questions that are happening after 11:15, that you try and take them out into the hallway so that we make room for the next presentation. A little bit about this presentation. It will address the issues of healing in the aftermath of trauma and abuse, including hidden abuse, which leaves marks and scars not just on the body, but on the heart, soul, and spirit as well. Anna LeBaron is one of more than 50 children of an infamous polygamous cult leader, Irville LeBaron. She endured abandonment, horrific living conditions, and child labor. At the age of 13, she escaped and began a new life. A gifted communicator and personal growth activist, she's passionate about helping others walk in freedom. Anna lives in the DFW Metroplex and loves being a mom to 5 grown children. Thank you, Lisa. So as Lisa said, I'm the daughter of Irville LeBaron. My father was the leader of a violent polygamist cult that terrorized other polygamist communities in the 1970s and 80s to the point of ordering mob-style hits that were carried out by his followers on rival polygamist leaders. My father knew, without a shadow of a doubt, that he was the one mighty and strong, quote, unquote, that Joseph Smith prophesied about in section 85 of the Doctrine and Covenants. So anyone else laying claim to the title was obviously mistaken and a false prophet, and therefore needed to be blood atoned. The theme here at Sunstone is there is more than one way to Mormon. My father would have disagreed violently with Lindsay Park about that. There was only one way to Mormon, and it was his way or the highway. Or, more accurately, it was his way or a shallow grave by a highway. My mother was the fourth of my father's 13 wives, and I was one of more than 50 children fathered by him. I was born in 1968 in Colonia LeBaron in Chihuahua, Mexico, where my father and his brother Joel were co-leading the fundamentalists that lived there. Joel was considered to be the prophet, reluctant as though he was, and my father wanted to take over. But so many balked at his leadership style that eventually the men parted ways and there was a church split. The Irvillites, as our family became known later, left the LeBaron colony in 1969 when I was just 9 months old. If you're even a little bit good with math, it doesn't take a lot of figuring to realize that one man cannot support so many wives and children. So some of the wives would go off to work, and most went on welfare to help make ends meet. The ends did not always meet, though. So oftentimes I would find myself as a 9-year-old girl as we backed up the car to a dumpster, and I would be lowered into the dumpster to rummage around for discarded dairy products and maybe fruits and vegetables that could not be sold in the stores. Because we sometimes found fruits and vegetables, that practice had a euphemism that we used called gardening. We also had another practice with a strange euphemism called gift boxing. And we would back up to the Goodwill boxes where bags of clothing items had been donated, and I would be put into the Goodwill box, and I would hand out the bags to somebody waiting on the outside. And then it would be like Christmas Day, because we did not celebrate that pagan holiday. But we would go home, and like Christmas Day, we would open those bags up and try to see which clothes would fit which of the 20-some-odd children that lived in a small 3-bedroom home. Once the clothing items had been dispersed, everything that didn't work for us would be put back into the bags and the next day piously donated back to the Goodwill box. Two or more of the wives usually shared a home, and so there were always lots of kids around to play with and fight with, as you can imagine. And that was good, because we were not allowed to make friends with anyone outside of our group. That was called fraternizing with the enemy. So anyone who did not fall in line with my father's orders was considered an outside, or worse, an apostate. Sometimes my mom would go off to work with the other wives, and sometimes she would be the one to stay at home and take care of the children. Of course, I always liked it best when she was the one at home taking care of the children. She did have so many to look after, though, that I didn't always get the attention that I wanted and that every child needs. We were a very tight-knit group, and the adults were not allowed to leave once they had joined. If, after joining, they decided that our group was not for them and they left, they were usually found dead not long after. My father and his followers that carried out his orders were wanted by the law for those hits that he had ordered. Ultimately, he was responsible for the deaths of 28 people confirmed, and up to 38 people, depending on which investigator is doing the counting. We lived a very transient lifestyle, moving from city to city, and even to Mexico and back, several times, in an attempt to stay ahead of the law that was determined to find my father. On several occasions, I vividly recall being awakened in the night by either the noise or the chaos of the FBI, if we lived in the United States, or the Mexican police when we lived down there, as they were searching our home for my father and other group members. One time they occupied our home for what felt like days as they were waiting in stealth mode for my father or other group members to walk through the door. Other times we were awakened in a hurry, taken to a waiting vehicle, and we would disappear into the night, leaving all of our belongings behind. Moving unexpectedly and often was a part of life that I knew and accepted as a child. It felt normal to me. I left important belongings behind each time we moved in such a hurry, and it happened quite often. We lived a life characterized by fear, chaos, and insecurity. My mother's presence, love, and care were a constant source of comfort and stability in those chaotic,
early childhood years. But life as I knew it was about to change, leaving me without the source of comfort that I depended on. I was 9 years old, and we were living in Denver, and we had just moved again, and I was doing my best to settle into our home and new school. We weren't in that home but what felt like a few weeks, when again, we were awakened in the middle of the night. I was told not to ask any questions, and then I was loaded up into the back of a station wagon and driven more than 1,500 miles into the heart of Mexico. What happened next changed the heart of a 9-year-old girl. Arrangements for our care had been made with some new group members that I was not familiar with. And then just like that, my mother was gone. With her went the stability and the comfort that I had known and depended on all my life. I don't remember having anything explained to me at the time, where she was going, how long she would be gone, and most importantly, would I ever see her again? Days turned into weeks, weeks turned into months, and then more than a year passed before I saw her. We were left in a small cement-floored apartment in the care of a woman who did not appreciate the extra work required to care for and feed several additional children. I was put to work in the home of the family that lived down below us, helping with household chores. My meager wages were paid to my caregivers. I would also be sent door-to-door down in Mexico as a little blonde child by myself, selling cake slices one by one, or rocks that we had found and painted, and I would sell them as paperweights. My caregiver's husband had been promised a few of my father's daughters when they were old enough to marry off, which in our community was right about age 14. He was promised this in return for his faithful obedience. And that meant that us girls in particular were a threat to her still monogamous marriage. She was young and jealous of any attention that her husband paid to us, and she took every opportunity to shame and humiliate my siblings and me. Being young and not understanding the dynamics of what was happening among the adults, I felt abandoned and alone, even though I had siblings nearby. I remember at one point standing at a bedroom window, looking off at a mountain range far off in the distance. And I remember thinking to myself, if I could just somehow get over that mountain, that's where my mom is, and I could be with her. However, the mountains were further away than my 9-year-old legs could take me, so the impossibility of that journey weighed heavy on my heart. I longed to be with my mom and felt helpless to change my circumstances. I was eventually reunited with my mother, but the damage to my heart had already been done. And I began to see life through a pair of clouded lenses that I began calling sadness and uncertainty, caused by the extended separation from my mother. Later in life, as I received professional care, I came to know those two things as those lenses as depression and anxiety. Until a few years ago, the only pictures I had of my father were newspaper clippings. One of him that was found in this very reliable newspaper called the National Enquirer. You can see the headline, JFK assassination, cult leader is number one suspect. I'm not sure how they made this connection between my father and JFK, but my guess is that the letters that he used to write to the U.S. presidents, yes, plural, demanding that they tithe to him, are probably connected. So in that National Enquirer, there was a picture of him in handcuffs that was taken when he was arrested in Mexico the first time. He was arrested twice, eventually. The second time, he was taken to the Mexican-American border and taken into custody by the FBI agents waiting for him on the other side. My father was tried right here in Salt Lake, convicted, and sentenced to life in prison for the death that he ordered against Reuben Allred. As children, we were not told that my father was ordering hits on rivals and apostates, or would-be apostates. Sometimes if you just threatened to leave and tell the police what you knew, you would be taken out. And we did not know that it was his followers, people that we cared about, that were carrying out his orders. After my dad was in prison, he had only slightly less control of the group members. I had an older brother that was living and working in Houston, and he wanted a better life for us. I remember the day that he pulled up with a U-Haul truck, and for what felt like the very first time, we packed up all of our things and then moved. It was while living in Houston that I experienced my first taste of life with a sense of stability and less of the chaos caused by my father's influence. While we were in Denver, prior to moving to Houston, we were living in abject poverty and squalor, dumpster diving for food and clothes. We were worked like slaves, 12-hour days, and we were not paid for our work. In Houston, we still had to work. We were still part of the community, but the people that were responsible for that part of our group that was in Houston actually paid us $5 a week for working after school and for normal hours on Saturday. I was a saver, and I would save up my $5, and eventually I would save up enough to buy myself a brand new pair of Gloria Vanderbilt jeans. And then I saved up my $5 again and bought myself a pair of two-tone brown Nike tennis shoes. I had my hair feathered in the Farrah Fawcett style that was popular back in the day, and I felt like I was hot stuff. We had been in the same house for about a year, the longest I'd ever lived anywhere, when the phone rang on a Sunday morning. I picked up the receiver, but before I could say hello, I realized that my mother had already answered the phone upstairs. Do y'all remember those kinds of phones way back in the day? And I overheard the caller giving her the news that my father had been found dead in his prison cell right here in Draper. Not having spent any amount of time with my father, I met him when I was 9, living in Mexico, and remember being in the same room with him twice. I found it difficult to mourn my father's death as a normal child would. I can look back now and see that when my father died, what God says in Psalm 68:5, where he calls himself a father to the fatherless, became true in my life. My biological father's death began a chain of events that would eventually become the reason that I'm standing with you here today. He died without a clear successor, leaving our group in chaos, and with several of his followers vying for his position of power and influence. Not long after my dad died, I somehow figured out that my mother had decided to move back to Denver and to the poverty and squalor that we had been experiencing there. I wanted nothing to do with that life again. So I called an older sister that I could tell just by observation that she was on the fringes of our group and not planning to move to Denver. I let her know that I didn't want to go, and she said these two words to me, "Start walking." I hung up the phone, made sure I was wearing my Gloria Vanderbilt jeans and my Nike tennis shoes, and walked out of my house with just the clothes on my back. I had walked just a little over 3 miles when she found me and picked me up. If any of you do any kind of walking or running, you know that just a little over 3 miles is a 5K. So I call that my 5K to freedom. The first night, my sister took me to another sister's house and let me stay the night there. About midnight, that sister woke me up, told me to go through the bedroom window, out into the backyard, and crawl through the hole in the fence, and to stay there until she came and got me. What I didn't know was that my mother was at the door looking for me. The next day, they took me and put me in a hotel where I was hidden for 3 days. My mother looked for me that one night, and when she couldn't find me, she packed up all my other siblings into the back of that station wagon, and again, they left everything behind and she moved them to Denver. My sister and I waited until we were sure they were long gone and drove back to the recently abandoned house. It felt dark and ominous walking into that house, like I was walking into a trap. But I was determined to have my belongings move with me to my sister's home. They very reluctantly enrolled me in a private Christian school that was just down the road from their home. I go into details about that decision that they made, and you'll understand more why how they were able to come to that decision if you read the book. They considered me learning about the Christian Jesus the lesser of two evils when compared to the public schools in their area, where drugs, sex, and rock and roll meant they could end up with a pregnant, unwed teenager on their hands. Several of the students there embraced the new girl, and they became the first real friends I ever had outside of our cult. The teachers there were given just enough background information about my family of origin that they collectively made an extra effort with me. The kindness and the love and the acceptance that they showed me was very different than anything I had ever experienced, and nothing like what I expected from the Gentiles that were on the outside. I eventually came to the place where I began to have different thoughts about God than what I had been taught growing up. What I know for sure is that my life had been turned upside down and my heart was shattered in pieces. During my time at that school, the broken heart of a 13-year-old girl began to be put back together, one broken piece at a time. Growing up in the cult during my teenage years and even into my adulthood, my circumstances have often felt impossible, much like when I was a 9-year-old girl staring off at that mountain range in the distance. Thank you. the trauma I experienced, along with every kind of abuse you are probably imagining in your mind right now, left my heart in need of help, the professional kind of help. Not all abuse leaves marks and scars on the body. What I've come to know as the hidden abuses leave marks and scars on the heart, soul, and spirit of a person. In our modern age, these hidden abuses are called different things. Verbal abuse, emotional abuse, mental abuse, psychological abuse, and yes, even spiritual abuse. I did not receive any kind of professional counseling during my teen years when I was desperately in need of it, but we just didn't understand that it was needed. It was 13 years later, in 1995, as a grown adult woman with three children of my own, when I finally got some help. I had attended the wedding of one of my nieces. And there, several family members that I had not seen ever were brought. And because so much time and distance had been placed between me and my family of origin and the trauma that I experienced, when I first saw these individuals, I was delighted to meet them. They were my nieces and nephews that I did not know. We took pictures, and it was a great reunion. However, when I went back home and fell asleep that night, what I didn't understand is that sometimes these kinds of things can trigger feelings and emotions, and I was not expecting that. That night I woke up in the middle of the night after having had a nightmare in which I dreamed that family members pulled up to my home in a brown van, got out of the car with guns, and came in and shot me. In my nightmare, I remember falling to the ground, and I was thinking to myself, just pretend you're dead. Because if you pretend you're dead, they won't shoot you again. And when they leave, you can go check on your children. The next day, I had a play date planned with a friend who knew very little about my family, because at that point in time, I wasn't talking to anyone about it. It was way too shameful. Well, I told her about the dream or the nightmare, and she said to me, "If I make you an appointment with a lay ministry counselor, will you go?" Well, I wasn't even aware that I needed any counseling, but I agreed to go. And then she said to me, "Do you need me to drive you to the appointment? Or do you need me to watch your boys while you go?" This was a real friend who was determined that I was going to get some help. I went to that appointment and spent an hour, for the first time in my life, talking to a stranger about my family of origin. Very wisely, this lay ministry counselor, at the end of that hour, she handed me a business card to a professional counselor who just happened to have gotten her education and done her thesis on cults. I spent the next 5 years with this professional counselor doing what she called peeling back the layers of an onion. I remember the first day I was sitting in her office. Her name was Joy, which I love. I sat there in her office, and she asked me the typical question that you might expect. Tell me about your relationship with your father. My one sentence answer was, he was never around, and we dealt with it. I am projecting on her when I say that she was probably sitting across from me thinking in her mind, we have a lot of work to do. And we did. Because of the way I was raised and groomed to become a sister wife, we were taught to hide our feelings, especially the negative emotions. I didn't understand how to grieve. I didn't understand that there was anything actually wrong with me. And it was in the process of sharing with this trusted person that she earned my trust over time, where the first time I remember shedding one little tear over a memory that I'd shared with her, and I quickly shut that down. Because if I felt like if I started crying, I might never stop. So the next time and the next time and the next time, it took years for me to fully regain the very wide range of human emotions that are available to us, including the negative ones, like anger and jealousy and frustration. And I finally learned how to express those things. Researcher and storyteller Dr. Brené Brown says that we cannot selectively numb our emotions. When you numb the negative ones, you're also numbing the positive ones. And so it was while I regained my full expression of the wide range of emotions that I was able to go to the depths of grief about not just growing up fatherless and not just about the losses that we had endured, so many people that we loved and cared about. I was able to grieve the losses of the things that should have been and weren't. My healing journey at that juncture took 5 years, where I was able to finally get to the place where I felt normal and human again. But when I stopped seeing that counselor, my healing journey did not end. It was just the beginning of it. I have read so many books that have been so helpful to me. I've gone to retreats and done studies and participated in self-help groups and different ways of receiving the help and the care that I needed. Just the 5 years wasn't enough. As a child, we read voraciously. That was our escape. No matter where we went, my mother would get us library cards. And we would leave the library with stacks of books. And as I grew, the books became more and more mature, which is normal. as a teenager in that little school, I was reading all the romance novels I could get my hands on. They were Christian romance, so there wasn't any sex going on. But it helped me dream about ways in which I could engage with the world that were different than the way I was taught. As an adult, I read self-help books like they were going out of style. We have a term now that goes around on the internet called adulting. And I came to adulthood with zero adulting skills. Surprise, surprise. So I read voraciously all the books I could get my hands on about pregnancy and breastfeeding and homeschooling and money and marriage and family and raising children. And if I had a problem, I found out who the expert was on that problem and read their books and figured it out. All except I did have a problem with weight gain, because when you finally have access to food, you like to eat. And so the books I read about dieting didn't actually help me, because I like to eat more than I like to follow what the diet books said. I'm still working on that, and it's still a work in progress. One of the things that I have learned that I'm going to leave with you is I have learned that the only time we really have is what I call the immediate now. This breath that I'm taking, that I would like for you to take with me, a collective breath, because there's a lot of tension here. That breath that you're taking is the only moment that you really have. 5 minutes ago, 5 days ago, 5 years ago, we don't have any of that. And 5 minutes from now, none of us are guaranteed. 5 weeks from now, 5 years, we can make plans, and that's wise, but none of us are guaranteed another breath. It's just the only one that you are taking right now that's guaranteed. And I've learned that it's in the immediate now. That's the only time that you can really help yourself. For me, when I made the decision in the immediate now to accept my friend's offer to go to counseling, and then as the weeks passed, showed up at that counseling appointment, and made that decision in that immediate now. There's been a lot of immediate nows since those days. I'm now 48 years old, and I've had a lot of immediate nows in the years since then, where I have been able to walk a path, making one choice after another, that changed the trajectory of my life and allowed me to be with you here today, able to tell my story and share it. I want to make sure that we have plenty of time for Q&A. And the topic of my talk, healing in the aftermath of trauma and abuse, if we could keep the questions mostly on that topic, but I will answer any questions that you have. But if you have questions about the topic of my healing journey, I would love to answer those for you. One of the books that I read that helped me is called Healing from Hidden Abuse: A Journey Through the Stages of Recovery from Psychological Abuse. The author of this book, I contacted her before I was coming today or to speak here. And I asked her where I could get a bulk discount so I could give these away. And she said, well, how many do you need? And I said, well, probably like 10 or 12. And she goes, how about 15? I'll give you 15 and you can just give them away. So I've already given away some as I've talked to people in the hallway. And I have some left over. Adine? They're at my book table. And if you would like to take a copy of this book home with you, just raise your hand, and a dean will give you a little slip of paper that will, you can get one at the table, at my book table. My friend Takoa, that's been with me on my book tour, this is now day 103. She will have those at the table for you when you see her there again. So, if you have any questions, not working.
The abuse that you experienced had religious origins. And yet, at one point, you found that religious didn't have to be a negative. And so, can you share about how faith played out within your healing process?
I believe that the love and the acceptance and the kindnesses that I was shown by my school teachers was the beginning of a healing journey for me. They were living out the things that we all believe in: love, joy and peace and kindness, patience. They were walking the walk, and that helped me a lot.
You haven't said much about your marriage, and it would seem to me that that would be one of the more difficult challenges to overcome some of the abuse that you've had. Do you have anything that you're comfortable in sharing about that journey?
Yes. I met a boy at that school, and we dated for 7 years, which wasn't exactly dating, as we would understand it, because my sister didn't believe in it. So we spent time at school and church and at different events that we got to attend, getting to know each other, and eventually we got married right before my 21st birthday. We had 5 children together. They're all now grown. Thank you, Jesus. Done with that. Well, not done parenting. Those of you with older children know that's not where I'm not really done. But right now, my youngest is 18 and just graduated from high school. So I feel a sense of relief. What you might expect, and you would probably understand, is that I was ill-equipped for marriage. I grew up raising babies and raising other people's babies and taking care of other people's babies, so child-rearing was something that came natural to me and I enjoyed. But the marriage part, I was not equipped for that. We ended up divorced 10 years into our marriage, and then after getting professional help and marriage counseling, we were able to patch that marriage back together, and we remarried. And then 7 years later, we ended up divorced again. I don't want to go into the struggles because that we experienced publicly, just because my children lost their father last year to cancer. And so they're in the grieving part of that. And so there will become a time when it's a better time to share about the struggles that we experienced in the marriage. It's just not right now. Any other questions?
Many years ago, I worked with a wonderful person who is your cousin. And one thing that she shared with me was that Ervil was her favorite uncle, that he was kind and good to her. It's interesting. One of her big griefs was that her family could never have a reunion. It could never come back together. And I'm wondering, is the family healing? Is it coming back together?
The answer is yes. I'm really happy to say that. I have many family members here today with me, supporting me as I share. Our family was dispersed to the north, to the four winds, and for a lot of years I was out of contact with them. Things calmed down, and the whole group that my father had finally disbanded, and there's nobody now that believes anything about my father or what he taught, and nobody believes that he was an actual prophet. And our family, over the years, has managed to cobble together the kind of relationships that have given our lives a lot of meaning today. In 2009, I discovered Facebook. And it opened up a whole new world to me. And it opened up a lot of connections between family members that were very leery of one another, just based on the fact that we didn't know who the good guys were and who the bad guys were anymore for the longest time. So we had family that we would call the bad family, brothers and sisters that we labeled bad because they did bad things. And so we managed in the last, 2017, to finally find a forum where we could safely engage one another and learn about one another and begin to experience life with one another again. And even the bad family, that they had probably suffered more than anything I've shared with you here today. Finally, we're able to change the trajectory of their lives as well and become contributing members of our society. So connecting with them was fraught with tension and a lot of fear because we just didn't know. But we were able to put those relationships back together, and I'm in contact with all of my siblings that want to be in contact with me through the magic of Facebook, and we've been putting the pieces back together of our family for years now. My mom still believes in the principle of polygamy and is part of a community of polygamists. In this case, she is allowed to have contact with outsiders, and I am clearly an outsider. And so I'm grateful for that.
Anna, that's so awesome to hear that. Thrilled about that. Just so exciting. I have helped many survivors and been involved in their recovery in life, and so awesome to meet you. And I wanted to ask you, because in their lives and in my life, there was a lot of sexual abuse, and that was one you didn't address. Was that, or do you know if that was part of the cult you grew up in or around or the surroundings?
It was absolutely a part of our cult. I didn't list it in the hidden abuses because that wasn't my experience. Somehow I was spared from that. But many, many, many of my siblings were not. But it is one of the hidden abuses. But it is one that it's a bodily abuse, not hidden. So,
I'm curious where you landed as far as faith and religion, if you're comfortable sharing that. What role does that still play, I guess?
Yes.
To the theme of this conference, what kind of Mormon are you?
Well, my tag says that I'm an ex-fundy Mormon, with the fun part capitalized and highlighted in red to emphasis on the fun. It is a lot more fun for me to be ex-fundy. As far as my own personal faith practice, I have narrowed down a lot and discarded a lot of beliefs that were not serving me or my family really well, and have landed in a place where right now and for now, I consider myself to be a follower of the historical man Jesus. The fruit of the Spirit of Jesus is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, gentleness, faithfulness, and self-control. Those fruits are what nourish my life and the lives of the people around me. And so that's where I'm focused on for now. I think one more question.
Thank you again for your comments. And I did have a question in kind of a general sense. There are all these various groups of fundamentalists, shall we say, and they probably have different experiences and maybe some of the same experience, the imprisonment or inability to go out and go to a public school and meet with other kids. I've heard those things. One time I drove down to San Quintín in Mexico and saw a small group living off the ocean, the sea, and had a windmill, and they did very well. They raised corn. Not a very large group, but are there some very positive experiences? Are there a lot of negative experiences? What's the range of the fundamentalist movement, from what you know?
My experience, I did have several positive experiences in the group. One of them was my very close connection and bond with my siblings, because we were all each other had. And that bond continues to this day. There are so many of my siblings that I am very close to, very bonded with, and we live life together. We have reunions, we have happy times. One of the things that I'm most proud of is the fact that we can have experiences today that finally, we've gathered enough experiences along the way, reunions and times at the beach and times for graduations and weddings, that we now have collectively more memories to talk about when we get together than just what happened in the past. But we did have happy times growing up. It wasn't all bad. What we experienced was very abnormal, and we made the best of it in spite of the circumstances. In the last 5 minutes here, I wanted to talk about something else, if you'll indulge me. I've attended several sessions here at Sunstone talking about fundamentalism and the groups that are there and different several sessions on ways that we can help them, especially the FLDS right there in Colorado City. Their lives are being turned upside down, and their apple cart's being turned over, so to speak. And there are very real needs for everyone in that community, ones that are still in the FLDS and ones that have been sent away and people that have gone away to live their lives. But the needs are real. And so what I would like to do today is there's two different ways in which help has been provided that I've learned about here at Sunstone, and one of them is through the Fern Foundation, and one of them is through Christine Marie, who is connecting with those people that are there, and they've learned to trust her. She's doing a fundraising and for getting them some school supplies for this coming school term. And so what I would like to do is, if you will make a donation of $20 or more, I will give you a copy of my book. They're already autographed, and they'll be outside the door there. Half of the money that's donated will be given to the Fern Foundation, and half of it will be given directly to Christina so that she can get school supplies for the children there that need them. So One of the passages that I read this morning was in Luke about the Good Samaritan. And when the story was told, somebody asked, you know, how do you love your neighbor? Or Jesus said, you know, love the Lord your God with all your heart and love your neighbor as yourself. And the lawyer, the one who wanted to justify himself about who he helped or didn't help or loved or didn't love, said, tell me who my neighbor is. And Jesus told the story of the Good Samaritan. There was a man left robbed, beaten, and left for dead on the side of the road. And the spiritual leader, the rabbi, walked on the other side of the road and passed him up and didn't help. And then somebody else passed him up and didn't help. And then the natural enemy, the Samaritan, of this person, came and found him bleeding and left for dead. And he took him and bound up his wounds and took him to an inn and told the innkeeper, I'm going away. Here's some money. Take care of this man. And when I come back, whatever other expense you've had, I will take care of that too. And then Jesus says, you go and do likewise. So our neighbor isn't always the people that we expect them to be. And so today I'm challenging you to consider that anyone that's part of that community is your neighbor and to give. So thank you.